serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 96-year-old Navy veteran Mike Kalustian of Visalia, California. Originally from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but for 3 years in the 1940s, his home was the cruiser USS New Orleans. He's one of the last surviving members of that crew and one of the last Navy vets who can still tell us about the Battle of Leyte Gulf, regarded as the largest naval battle in history. It was unfolding 76 years ago this weekend in late October 1944. It's the last time the world has seen a true Navy battleship clash with battle lines set up and guns firing back and forth. It was the first time the Japanese had employed organized and synchronized kamikaze attacks. The New Orleans was one of 300 American ships involved. And I'm wondering for you, Mike, as somebody that's helping to pass ammunition for 40-millimeter guns on the New Orleans, how exhausting, how nonstop was that, and what did you have to do?
And it was a big line, and we're loading, these things are heavy, and we're, these guys on the 40 millimeters wanted those shells because, you know, they can't fire. So the big line keeps going. Come on, you guys, push those, get those things up there. And they're heavy. They're loaded. There's four cases of four. That's 16 in a case that would have to, you have to load up to the after engine room. Mm-hmm. And you wanted to see what's going on because you hear the noise from the 40, pop, 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 you know, and you say, hey, they're going to hit us, you know.
And for those who aren't familiar, the 40 millimeter is an anti-aircraft gun.
Right, yeah.
So the job you're doing may make the difference with whether or not a kamikaze hits your ship.
Right, yeah.
So that's pretty important work.
Yeah. Our biggest danger was escorting a carrier. If there was a torpedo coming toward you, you were supposed to take that hit.
If you know that a submarine or torpedo bomber or whatever is targeting the carrier, the Enterprise, you guys are the sacrificial lamb that's supposed to turn your hull in front of it.
We were supposed to take the blow.
Yeah. In other words, you're expendable.
Right. Yeah.
Is that something where, again, I'm just asking because I wasn't there, I don't know, that Leyte Gulf battle.
Yes.
When that's finally over, is that a big sense of relief or wow?
Yeah, because we had killed, we had done, how many ships were lost? I think that was one of the biggest battles we had, and most of those people were gone, either sunk them or whatever, bombed them, whatever, in the planes by the Navy, chasing the enemy back to their country, shooting them down, you know, hearing all this noise and flare and stuff. You know, it scared you. You wondered, hey, what's going on here? There's so many ships. You look like there's ships all over the place, all kinds of stuff. Transports, carriers, whatever.
And you said something there. You said, I heard you use the word scared. Yeah. And I never want that to seem like a trite question. I know it's serious business, but were you scared? Were you concerned that you might not make it home?
Right, that time, yeah.
Is that something you thought about much, whether or not you'd survive?
Before, I didn't think about it, but now that war, with all these worst battles going on, it scared me. I said, hey, I may not make it, you know. Mm. And I said, oh, gee, thinking about home and what's going to happen if I don't go back.
You mentioned Okinawa.
Yeah.
You guys had to come to the rescue of some Marines who were cut off, surrounded. You did that. And I'm guessing you were probably there quite a while at Okinawa.
We were there. We bombed that island for a while before it landed. We would transplant from a couple islands away from us, and we would go there, load up, go back, and battle Okinawa for I don't know how long before the early Marines landed. And to me, it was Easter Sunday that the Marines landed on Okinawa. Mm-hmm. We would go there and bomb. You know, how many bombs we bombed? Days and days we bombed. And still, when they went to land the Marines, they were under battle. They were hurt. There was all kinds of mines. I give credit to the Marines for a lot. You got to have guts to be in World War II or any war, you know.
Did you guys ever bring wounded Marines aboard your ship?
Yeah. We brought that Hank group. I don't know how many guys were hung up. We came around and got them. The medical helped them cure whatever damage they had. After a while, we loaded them onto the new crews.
Did you have a sense that things were getting close to the end, that Japanese may surrender soon?
No, I didn't think. No, I didn't think about hey, it's still going to be over with now. In 45 August, when the war was over with, that was a nice relief. And then they found out that you could get discharged by the number of points. Then we found out if you send all those people, like the engine room or the cooks, or where, you could not get discharged. Because who would run that ship if there was nobody on board with intelligence to run their ship? So our points were off. Still, you couldn't go. You had to stay on board the ship. So I had to stay on the ship for another year, going back and forth to Japan and patrolling the Yellow Sea between Korea and China. We knew then in Korea that the Third Liberal, that's where the next war is going to be. We just knew that. From the instinct, the enemy would come out and say, you can't go, you got to go get, you know, go in China, don't go on our side, we don't want you.
You could see it already,
yeah,
right. 46.
They would chase you out.
What was the hardest thing to deal with? Because you were on that ship for, what, 2.5 years?
43, 44, 45, 46, 4 years. The hardest part was when the war was over with, I can't go because our chief machinist mate, engine room, you got to learn how to stay on board, drive that ship. You got to have a cook to cook the food, the laundry. You know, life goes on still, even though
you had the points, but they needed you to run the ship.
Even the war's over,
So that was the biggest challenge for you.
Yeah, that I had to stay longer.
Did you get much mail from home while you were on the ship?
No, we got very few mail. The only time we got called if a mail ship had food that came towards us, like for food or oil or whatever, they would have some mail care and they would give it to you. My first Christmas gift is 1944, so that's almost a year and a half before I got my presents. The cookies and everything were all crumbled, mail was disordered, you know, it was.
So you got a package from home and were kind of excited.
Yeah.
Until you opened it up?
There's nothing in there, all crumbled.
Did you eat the crumbs?
No.
You know, you bring that up, and I know Christmas time is always different for you because your birthday is only 8 days before it. What's it like celebrating Christmas on a ship in the middle of a war?
Oh, I said, you know, hey, I'm going to have my birthday come in December. Where's my presents? Where's my gift? What am I, you know, because I expected my birthday gift and the Christmas gift at the same time. I told my parents, I want two gifts, my birthday and my birthday. I didn't want just one for Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted both for my family, my kids. I wanted both gifts. And that was missing because you didn't have it. And the war would go by, you know, January, February. Well, then comes another war. And no mail, because sometimes we would be hired by some ship. By the time they got to where you could get something free, you know, where it's safe to land your, bring your ship there, because it's like fuel oil and whatever. We had to meet at around at a certain time to get your oil and food. And if you didn't have it or something came up, that was it. You were gone. You're missed. We'd be out so long that the flour that they made the bread with was full of maggots, bugs. The first couple of days, we didn't mind. You could pick them out. But after a while, they got so, were so many, we would take and cover them up with oleo or jelly and just eat it.
Extra protein.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure there are a lot of things you had to get used to.
At home, I would make my mad, you know, to do that. You eat like that, you know.
Well, what was it like to come back home after all that time on ship?
Okay, when I finally got discharged from the Pacific, we had to go through the Panama Canal, which was very interesting. How up and down. Took a while to get through there. Then we went all the way around to New Orleans and docked there in downtown, and we let the servant come and see our ship with his name and everything. Then
because you're on the ship to New Orleans, and you actually bring it back to New Orleans.
Right. We were right downtown. We made a couple of days liberty. Then from there, we went to Philadelphia, gave the ship to Mattball people, and we got our crews to come to Great Lakes on the train.
Was it challenging for you to get back to civilian life after being around all those Navy guys for those years?
The most important thing was our conversation, our words. Our regulation was terrible. Oh, we couldn't speak English without swearing. Oh, it was really bad. My mother would slap my mouth every time I couldn't, it was just one of those things, I couldn't learn to, how not to say the bad words. But after a while, we got into the factory, and then we started, friends were getting married, little by little, friends were finding a girlfriend, getting married. And after a while, some guy came up to me. He was Armenian, married to a non-Armenian. Came to me and said, "Don't you know nice Armenian girl you could marry?" I said, "There's only one I like, you know." And my cousin calls her home in Racine. She was in South Milwaukee by her niece's house, you know, visiting. And so I called her, asked an appointment, made an appointment with Elsie to see her in Racine. There was an Armenian affair going on there next week. Mm-hmm. She said, "Okay, I'll meet you there." And that was it. I met her. We fell in love more. I got married in 53, had 54 and 56. Then we came to California. Life goes on.
How'd you end up here in Visalia?
My brother was here. He married an Armenian girl. She had visited Milwaukee to some friends. Well, Harry got to see her. He liked her. And when she went back, he went back and met her. She married him. And she says, "Come out here, it's warmer. You know, nice out here." And so we locked up our family, went to Visalia, and that was it.
I know it's not easy to always answer a question like this or see it, but those years for you from age 19 to 22, 23, those are some pretty important years that,
yeah,
that you were wearing that uniform and serving on the USS New Orleans. How do you think that affected the rest of your life? How do you think your service in the Navy had an impact on the rest of your life?
Well, I think my brain should have been thinking better about being more accurate with yourself. You know, find something professional and do it. You know, grow up. Maybe you're a young man now. You're going to vote, this and that. And we just went around. We belonged to the 5250 Club, which was dumb. But none of us didn't want a gang of our gang. We did get our $50 every other guy would get with a check, so we'd use that to go drink and whatever. I should have matured. I should have went to Marquette like I should have, you know, because it was free, nothing to do, and you could have got any trade you wanted, what experience you wanted.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I know, you know, one thing a little more recently that you experienced 5 years ago, you and your son-in-law got to go with a bunch of other veterans and their guardians on an honor flight, Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial.
Those others.
What was that like for you?
That was very exciting. I first time ever been to Washington, but to be on the beautiful countries with all these people on board that ship that were like me, an ex-veteran of whatever, and to go to Washington, D.C. and see all these beautiful places, it was very, very rewarding. Now, Bill took good care of me.
I'm sure he did. To be at that World War II Memorial, it's a pretty big place.
Yeah.
You know, there's a pillar that says California, where you live now. There's one that says Wisconsin, where you grew up.
Yeah.
There's the fountain there. There's the Atlantic and the Pacific. And then there's 4,000 gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home.
Right.
What did you think about when you were looking at that?
When I went there, my biggest thing that made me cry was when I saw the Korean memorial with those Marines with their drained and draped. And when you're walking, you could look at a guy and he looked like he couldn't at you. He's looking at, as you walk, he's looking at you, he's looking. Oh, it was, that's one of the murals, that was one of the worst ones. The Air Force, the Army, this was the worst of it. To me, it was the one that really touched my heart.
So at the Korean War Veterans Memorial, there's all, they call them the ghost soldiers
out there. Yeah.
And you're saying when you walked by, it seemed like the statue's eyes were following you?
Right. If you followed one guy, he'd follow you. It was one of those. To me, it was one of the worst murals that I saw that bring tears to my eyes.
Yeah. When you say the worst, you mean the most haunting or stirring,
right,
emotional?
The most, yeah. They're all nice. They're all great. Yeah. But I'm telling you, the one that touched me the most was the Korean War.
And you had been off the coast of Korea at the end of World War II, but your brother fought in the Korean War.
Right, my brother fought the Korean War.
And, you know, and I bring up the gold stars at the World War II Memorial, because a lot of the guys that I meet now know somebody. Maybe it was someone back home in South Milwaukee or someone you met in the Navy along the way. Did you know anyone who didn't make it home from the war, who's one of those 406,000 who died?
I had a few, yeah. One was Charbonnerian. B-E-D-A-A-N, Charlie. He died in the Philippines. We grew up together as a buddy. He was about the same size as me and everything else. We enjoyed things together. But he went into the Philippines, and he got killed there. and to see their name on the gold plaque, it makes you wonder what's going on. Where was he? What happened? Why did he go away? Mm. Why did the war come? You wonder how many guys. The worst is when I keep bringing about the Navy, the war, the swimming. You know, you're dumb. What do you join the Navy for?
Yeah. When you read about ships like the Indianapolis or others that were sunk, and you would have been in the water.
Yeah, I would have been gone, you know, because I can't swim, and I was little. That's why I say, you know, Mike, you were lucky, you know. Your ship could have been, we could have been picked for the Indianapolis because they're a little older than us. See, the Indianapolis is an older ship. So yeah. They were picked him.
They were picked because they were fast, and they also happened to be at Mare Island at the right time.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. When you look back on almost 97 years now, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Well, I'm proud of joining the Navy and having God save me from disaster and come and be a wonderful, thankful American citizen. I fought in the war for my country. I love my country for now and now. I can see it now. People are honoring the World War II veterans. If you see a flag or a hat, honor, thank you, I'll buy your meal. They're all thankful. They're all thankful that you did your part, your share. We're proud of you. Thank you, buddy. I've had people from older people to younger kids buy me, thank you, and pay for my meal that I didn't know. When I really leave, it's been paid. So then when you say, hey, they're proud that they still live in this country.
And I would guess that most, if not all, of you listening right now can identify with those sentiments. Mike Kalustian of Visalia, California. He'll turn 97 8 days before Christmas. Check out the photos and a short video with Mike at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.